listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into governments-driven markets.
With Avasant's On the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer-in-residence. We're joined today by Matt Karas, senior associate at Avasant, who leads the firm's maritime systems and shipbuilding work. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So let's start off by talking about one of the few areas of certainty with the next administration's defense policies. A 350-ship Navy seems to be a pretty clear objective. That's also a long way from today's level of around 272 vessels. How do we get to there?
So I think here it's probably instructive to start with how we get to that number. The ship count thing is very emotive. Force structures always are, and I think that one's been around for a while, you know, really since the decline of the Reagan-era Navy after the Cold War. And, you know, the Navy is doing several force structure assessments right now, a couple internally, a couple externally, and the universal perception is that those are going to come back with numbers much closer to probably 350, maybe in the 320, 330 range than, you know, the 292 or the authorized force right now. And that really reflects sort of the invisible role the Navy's played since, you know, 2001 throughout, and then the acceleration of that in Asia Pacific over the last 5 or 6 years. The ships have been, you know, deployment schedules have been lengthened, cycle times are down, maintenance availabilities are down, costs for that, all of that is up. There's a lot of essentially, you know, deferred recapitalization or just ships that have really been ridden hard for 15 plus years. So, you know, it's not necessarily something that's coming out of thin air, that perception that we're undermanned from a ship capability or a ship number perspective, and the resulting impacts on personnel and the Navy as a whole, is that perception has been there for a while. The issue becomes, you know, with all those force structure questions, the Army's dealing with this because they're talking about all these extra brigade combat teams and everything else. With the Navy, it sounds like a simple question, but it's how you get there, how you afford that. Because a 350-ship Navy, the most obvious question is, where does the money come to buy those additional ships? And I'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, the other part of it is, how do you afford to operate them? Your operation sustainment costs will go up. You know, there are a couple of ways to get from where we are to 350. And one is building new ships. And we're not going to be building anything pretty much at a rate to actually increase the overall ship size, except for LCS, which, of course, is a very controversial program. The other option, or part of that, would be essentially dumping the previous administration's plan for the cruiser modernization and sort of laying them up for a while and then bringing them back later on and essentially splitting that number. But that gets you about 15 more combatants, a lot of VLS tubes, but only about 15 more hulls. So there aren't really a lot of fast, easy options of, you know, we're just going to go out and build a number of new ships. It takes obviously several years to build a large combatant and get them out to the fleet. And, you know, the SCN budget has been relatively stable with some increases. It's obviously popular in Congress, but how it goes up to a level that allows you to get to 350 over time is fanciful.
What's the capability that larger force offers the nation? Because that would seem to be a really important part of the conversation as well.
And this is the permanent debate the Navy has within itself and externally as well. And it's about presence versus capability. The reason for the lack of the number of ships is less about capability, although there are some capability gaps, anti-surface warfare, things like that. It's really about presence. It's about having to maintain forward deployed ships, operationally deployed ships in a lot of places. The line that we've got 10 carriers in a world that requires 15 has been out there since the end of the Cold War, and that's certainly gotten worse. You know, you have surface combatants doing ballistic missile defense missions at places like Rota, Spain, and in Asia Pacific. So you need the presence, you need forward deployment, you need to support allies and, you know, show the flag and all of that. But you also have a Navy that's transitioning very significantly in terms of capability. And they're looking towards future technologies to dramatically increase sort of the range and the lethality of both power projection ashore and its anti-surface capabilities. That's really rediscovered anti-submarine warfare over the last decade or so after 15 years out of the business. Same thing with mine warfare and a lot of the traditional sea control elements. So that argument, which really manifests itself in the LCS program, I mean, that's entirely about arguments about capability versus numbers and presence, is really sort of the key issue here.
So the kinds of ships that are going to make up a larger Navy would seem to be incredibly important in terms of their capability, but because that is directly linked to cost. When you look at LCS, you know, versus carrier, obviously dramatically different, you know, platforms, but trying to understand where the investment yield might be highest for the Navy, particularly in the context of the kind of reshaped naval alliances and, that you may see in the next few years.
So I think the Navy struggles with a couple of things that are somewhat at odds with each other. You know, one is the concern over the time and cost involved in designing a new combatant. Obviously, large-scale surface combatants or an aircraft carrier, submarines, you know, the submarine community will tell you that this is the hardest thing in the world. It's tougher than the space shuttle. And so the time that it takes, the cost of that sort of design work and production and getting those programs to a level of mature, stable, you know, sort of low-risk production is a very difficult one. And the Navy's risk-averse around that. We've seen that with what happened with the CGX program, you know, aversion to DDG 1000 and some other things. So there's that. There's also a concern that, and this, again, throughout DoD, it's not just a Navy concern, but it's essentially the, you know, it's the fallacy that we only have enough money to buy one, and therefore it has to be multi-mission. And so you're torn between increased use of sort of single-use, single-mission platforms that you can buy more of them, they're cheaper, you know, unmanned will certainly be a big part of this in the future. The Navy's made up for shortfalls by, you know, dragging the Special Operations Command, Coastal Patrol boats, you know, into operations in the Persian Gulf, you know, reactivating the minesweepers and moving them to Bahrain before they were retired, things like that to sort of fill those gaps. But from a large combatant perspective, the default setting is that we'll only be able to afford one, and so therefore it's got to be able to perform all of these missions. And you see that battle again with LCS, where it's like, do we want all of those capabilities in that ship, whether built-in or in modular, or do we want different variations of a hull form that can do different things? And I think that's the direction overall they're going to have to go, because it reduces the risk. You're seeing that with the DDG evolution from 51 Flight 1 to 2 to 2A to 3. The cost will still be higher than what the Navy has generally said, most likely, but it's largely successful, certainly more successful than the failed programs. I think when you get to the carrier level, what you're really going to see is just, you know, all of the it's essentially a production operational question. How do you reduce costs as much as possible? And that's where you see Huntington Ingalls looking into ways, whether it's demanning the shipyard or experiments with additive manufacturing and things like that. What can we do to just bring down what's essentially just an enormous production cost? Because until the paradigm of what a aircraft carrier looks like, there's just not a lot of room around the edges to sort of design it differently to reduce costs or this or that.
The community of shipbuilding workers in the U.S. is also shrinking. And how does that sync up with the ambitions to grow the force like this?
Well, it certainly challenges the ability or the willingness of Congress to support it. I think that, you know, outside of some of the very traditionally, you know, individuals have been very focused on sea power, Randy Forbes before he left, although he may reappear as Secretary of the Navy, it sounds like. A couple of other places, you know, really what has mattered has been in Congress is the job element. It's very political. If you start to see a reduction in that, you know, in places like Maine where, you know, Bath Iron Works is the largest private employer in the state, you know, you may see different political calculations in terms of, you know, supporting things like this where, you know, right now what you'd probably get is support for this almost as a jobs program in terms of a massive new investment in the shipbuilding account.
And as far as budget figures themselves, we're now around $155 billion for the Navy. You know, if the Budget Control Act changes, well, that's as much a matter of politics as it is policy. How do you see the need to essentially appropriate more money for the express purpose of shipbuilding playing out? And how fast does that money flow back into both industry, but also into the communities that are making these vessels?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, because one of the things that happened when sequestration first happened was, you know, because of the Navy's operational tempo, essentially, you know, O&M top lines came down, but to keep heavy operational tempos, particularly in CENTCOM AOR and in the Asia Pacific, everything that was in 5th or 7th Fleet was getting gutted in terms of spare parts and funding for repairs and maintenance availabilities and all of that. So there may well be essentially a deferred backlog of maintenance that has to happen, or just sort of restoring normal operations for other parts of the fleet. And that's going to absorb a lot of, you know, the whatever new money goes into that $155 billion figure. To your point about capabilities and some other things, you know, look, I'm a strong believer that the challenge the aircraft carrier has is less about the aircraft carrier right now than it is about the carrier air wing. So that Navy budget is going to have to cover what are future capabilities that an air wing is going to have that's going to make this enormously expensive asset useful. And I would argue that those capabilities, you know, the F-35 will help, but they don't exist yet, not in full form. And, you know, U-class, now C-bars and MQ-25. is only the start of that. So that requires investment. There are definitely a lot of cynics, myself included, who think that the Marine Corps always gets a disproportionate share when it comes to certain big ticket items, aviation. So CH-53K, V-22, things like that. The Marine Corps just announced its future UAV program. So there's going to be a lot of hungry mouths to feed for whatever extra money goes into the Navy budget. And then, you know, when you talk about how long it's going to take to get numbers up in terms of a shipbuilding side, where it's going to take, you know, years to get a new design or anything other than LCS or bringing all the cruisers back into service, it's not quite like a sudden turn on, turn off spigot.
When you look at the shipbuilding landscape, do you see any examples out there of programs that point to a way forward in terms of alternative approaches to, you know, construction or business models?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The most potentially impactful and program that's sort of resonating throughout the American shipbuilding landscape isn't even a Navy program. It's the Offshore Patrol Cutter, which was just awarded a couple months ago. And it was awarded to Eastern in Florida, who was competing against a traditional Coast Guard provider, Bollinger, and Bath Ironworks, the Navy's traditional service combatant yard, preferred yard. And, you know, one, for Bath Ironworks, it was a very significant loss in terms of their future pipeline. You know, obviously, there's a sole surface combatant yard. They don't have the diversification that HII does with some other programs. But it'll be very interesting to see what happens with Eastern, because there was no question that Eastern would be cheap. The question is whether or not, you know, essentially they can perform at something that would seem to be beyond their levels of engineering complexity and experience in programs that they've done. And yet they're well respected by other yards in the Gulf Coast. And if they can sort of, you know, punch some holes in the idea that, you know, only the big yards or only certain communities can execute on these, you know, programs of the scale and complexity, it may be very attractive to the Navy if they're looking for ways to, you know, sort of break the cost curve and find ways to procure capabilities at lower prices. It wouldn't affect any of the current shipbuilding programs because the costs of, you know, getting a new yard to build something it hasn't built before are enormous and everything else. But if you start thinking about maybe they're unmanned in the future, but smaller combatants, more specialized craft, you know, a yard like that or, you know, innovative production and design techniques could become much more significant.
As a closing question, let's talk about shipbuilding in Europe. We had Euronaval recently in October, where you saw some interesting developments around the French frigate, but also even an unmanned. What were some of the takeaways from that and what that indicates about the international shipbuilding market?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of interesting things at Euronaval. You know, one, I think you're seeing the European navies who, you know, we talk about the death spiral in the U.S. You know, Europe has been going through it for 20 years now, and you know, I think the difficulties that the generation of European service combatants have had in finding export markets to sort of alleviate cost pressures and production line issues has led to the new generation. The things that were unveiled or discussed heavily at Euronaval are explicitly focused on export markets and designed with those requirements in mind. You know, I think DCNS would view FREM as not being the success they would have wanted it to be in the export market. Type 26 on the British side, depending on what happens in Canada, might have a tough slog. They've been trying to get secure co-developers and buyers in India, Brazil, other places. There hasn't been the amount of success that I think those European yards were looking for outside of a few programs like Navantia's F-105, which has gone in a few places, and then the evolved versions of the Burke class, that an American class that the Japanese and Koreans have bought. So you're seeing explicit focus on the export side. You're seeing more willingness to look for different combat system integration partners, so less vertical integration, whereas in the past, you know, DCNS was sort of very, this is the set of equipment from Talos and from DCNS on the ship you're going to get. There's not a lot of customization. I think you're seeing more willingness to do that because the pressure is immense. The numbers, you know, in European home countries aren't enough to sustain the production volume and the production capacity that's there. So that's all out there. At the high level, there was some discussion both before and during the show of, you know, what does that industrial-based consolidation look like? Is there some sort of, there was talk of a naval Airbus between DCNS and Fincantieri, the Italian shipbuilder. You know, we'll have to see. You know, the politics around all of those makes it somewhat unlikely to me that you're going to see, you know, yards actually consolidate and certainly close facilities or anything like that. But what was really interesting from a capability perspective is you are seeing a lot more discussion about unmanned systems, about essentially building capability into some of these new designs or essentially design margin to operate future technologies. And not quite in the way that the U.S. went with LCS, where, you know, it's going to be modular and you know, you're going to have all these different, you know, sort of roll-on, roll-off packages. But just understanding that, you know, whether it's launch and recovery equipment, whether it's surplus electrical power, deck space, below deck space, there's a lot more attention being devoted to that. So certainly a lot more players coming on with different types of unmanned vehicles looking to get into that space. You know, a lot of different developments on that side.
Matt, thanks for joining us.
Great to have been part of it.
With Avasense On The Record podcast, I'm August Cole.
You've been listening to Avasense On The Record. To learn more about Avasense,